Over the last few weeks on The Law Report, we've been exploring issues around incarceration and rehabilitation upon release. We've looked at controversial recent changes at the WA Parole Board and also at innovative post-prison programs in Tasmania. Now, of course, in most parts of Australia, you can't really have a discussion about prisons and prisoners without addressing a crucial factor, race. This is especially true in WA. Peter Collins is the Director of Legal Services with the WA Aboriginal Legal Aid Service.
38.9% of the total adult prisoner population in WA is Aboriginal. And that's against a background where Aboriginal people comprise a touch under 3.5% of the total Western Australian population. And when it comes to juveniles, that's adults, when it comes to juveniles, Aboriginal kids, as we speak, comprise, and that's children under the age of 18 in juvenile detention centres in WA, they comprise 64.6% of the total juvenile custodial population.
What offences are Indigenous Australians locked up for in WA? I mean, do they fit the profile of the rest of the population?
That's a good question in the sense that there are lots of Aboriginal people in custody for very serious offending, serious offences of personal violence, sexual violence, armed robbery, offences of that nature, offences at the serious end of the spectrum. But equally, there are lots of Aboriginal people in custody for traffic offences, for driving when their licence has been suspended, for other traffic offences like drink driving. So Aboriginal people are in custody for offending which embraces the entire spectrum of criminal offending.
But do you think that they find themselves in jail for say, these driving offences at a higher rate than non-Indigenous Australians?
I think that's unarguably so, Damien, and a reflection overwhelmingly of the disadvantaged socio-economic conditions under which many Aboriginal people live in WA.
What about other offences that they might find themselves in prison for that you might find far fewer non-Indigenous Australians in prison for?
Well, you find people ending up in prison also, Damien, in WA for unpaid fines. And a very significant proportion of female Aboriginal people in jail in WA are in jail because they haven't been able to pay fines. In other words, they're in jail because they're poor.
Now, 2 weeks ago on The Law Report, we reported on the explosion in WA prisoner numbers over the last 12 months, and it seems as though the biggest factor behind this increase has been a decline in the number of prisoners who are obtaining parole. There's been a 65% decline in the number of prisoners getting parole. What impact has the explosion in prison numbers had on Indigenous people?
You know, when you drill down on the statistics, Damien, in WA, the Aboriginal rate of imprisonment is 26 times the rate of non-Aboriginal imprisonment. And tonight, that means one in every 12.5 Aboriginal men in this state will spend the night in prison. So you've got
one in 12 Indigenous men in WA are in prison tonight.
Will be in jail tonight, that's correct.
The 65% decline in the number of prisoners getting parole, and that's accompanied a 25% rise in the number of prisoners overall in the state system, that coincides with the appointment of Justice Narelle Johnson as chair of the review board, I think, in about March or April last year. Now prior to her arrival, prisoners would have the opportunity to present their case for parole or their case for a review of a parole decision, and that was done personally or face-to-face. And by that I mean either via a video link or actually face-to-face in sort of an office context. What's your view of this change?
Well, I think there's something inherently seriously procedurally unfair in a prisoner not being able to present their case face-to-face to the parole board. And the inherently procedurally unfair aspect of it is compounded almost exponentially in the case of Aboriginal prisoners. Overwhelmingly, most Aboriginal prisoners in jail, as we speak, have very, very low levels of literacy. They don't write, and their numeracy skills, as part of that, are very poor as well. I'm not talking about someone who might read or write in a rudimentary way. I'm talking here about people who can't write in English at all, save perhaps to write their name for the purposes of, for example, filling out a Centrelink form. That's the level at which many, many Aboriginal prisoners, both adults and juveniles, are functioning at in terms of their literacy skills. So it is inconceivable that these people are going to be in a position to do themselves justice when their case for parole is being considered if they cannot appear in person. In addition to that, there's no one out there who can provide the sort of assistance these prisoners need to present their case in writing.
Narelle Johnson says, look, it's open to prisoners to put their cases in writing, and this is done. And where there are literacy problems, prisoners can get assistance to put their arguments together, either from prison officers or from peer supports or from other forms of assistance.
Well, that argument just doesn't hold water from where I sit, because with all the goodwill in the world, you can't legitimately assert, in my view, that prisoners are going to be properly supported and given the right assistance with this sort of exercise from prison guards, from people who are employed by the very agency who are responsible for their incarceration. There may be prison officers who may have, not a vested interest, but they may have a desire, for example, the person stay in jail for longer.
But the argument put is that the board members should look at the papers, they should look at the facts, they should look at what the experience has been of the prisoner in terms of their record and what have you, rather than, you know, hearing what is sometimes an emotional plea. No doubt it's heartfelt when they're giving this emotional plea and putting their arguments forward, but it's very important to look at the actual facts and make a kind of a cold, hard calculation about somebody's likelihood of reoffending or the likelihood of success of parole.
But the personal appearance of the individual prisoner in front of the board shouldn't preclude the board from making an appropriate, lawful decision based on all the materials. I mean, lawyers like myself, every day of the week, appear in courts for people who've either pleaded guilty or been found guilty, making these so-called heartfelt pleas on behalf of their clients. That's the nature of the system. That's my job. And it's the responsibility of a judge or a magistrate, or in this case the board, to sift through all of the material that's put before them to arrive at the appropriate decision. I can't accept that that's an appropriate basis for not allowing people to appear either in person or on a video link.
So you would argue that the face-to-face contact adds something rather than detracts or provides a distraction from the issues at the heart of a parole board hearing?
It could never be a distraction. It's an issue as to fairness. And as part of all of this, you've got to realise that so many of these people are just terribly marginalised. They're completely disenfranchised. They've been wrong-footed, pushed to the side throughout all of their lives, and the court system compounds that. I've had clients who've been sent to jail for many years for serious offences who I've spoken to in the cell immediately after court, and they've said to me, "What's happened? Am I going to jail?" They don't understand what's going on. And you know, so you have a situation where you can't appear in person or on a video link, and you've got to do your best in writing, and what happens? You get a letter from the parole board saying, "Sorry, we haven't given you parole." I mean, it just compounds that sense that they're not legitimately part of the whole process.
Moving on, Peter Collins, prison and incarceration conditions in WA, they're issues you feel very deeply about. For some time now, you've been closely involved in the case of a Mr. Ward who is Mr. Ward.
An incredibly important and highly regarded Nunanjara man from the Nunanjara lands, which, Damien, is a remote part of WA near the NT-WA South Australian border. He was a man of enormous achievement who not only worked tirelessly to preserve and promote his culture and traditional values, but was one of those rare people who had the capacity to walk in both worlds, a very important person in the non-Aboriginal world in all sorts of areas, but in particular with native title negotiations, in his dealing with government, in those sorts of areas. He died on the 27th of January in the back of a prison van.
The 27th of January 2008.
That's right. Back of a prison van, which was driven on an incredibly hot day, over 40 degrees. The air conditioning in the van wasn't working. He wasn't provided with adequate supplies of water. The journey was nearly a 4 hours duration. He wasn't shown a duress button in the back of the van. The van itself was very small with largely metal surfaces, and he died of the effects of heat exhaustion. It was an indescribably appalling and unnecessary event, which was an indictment on Western Australia.
Mr. Ward was arrested, for drink driving, and was in the process of being transported from the town of Laverton to the town of Kalgoorlie, where he was to appear before a court on that drink driving charge.
That's correct.
What were the findings of the coroner, and have there been any proceedings commenced as a result of this death?
The findings were absolutely damning insofar as the role of the two drivers of the van were concerned, who were employees of a multinational custodial company called, at that time, GSL, they're now called G4S. Damning in terms of the company itself, and also of the Department of Corrective Services in relation to what occurred, because the company had a contract through them for the transportation of prisoners. And what's happened since? We've been successful in negotiating with the state government of Western Australia an ex gratia payment for the family of $3.2 million, which was announced recently. As part of the announcement of the ex gratia payment, the state attorney general acknowledged the terrible wrongdoing of the state in Mr. Ward's death, expressed his deep remorse, which I believe was very sincerely felt over what occurred, and they are very important pronouncements by the government, given the involvement of the government in what transpired.
Do you see the death of Mr. Ward as part of some of the wider issues around incarceration of Indigenous people that we've been talking about?
I do, for this reason. The evidence given in the inquest from police officers from Laverton who arrested him was to this effect. First of all, Mr. Ward had driven in from the Nunanjara lands at night to Laverton. Laverton is a very small town, a population fluctuating, given the numbers of Aboriginal people that come and go, between a couple of hundred and 1,000, I think, off the top of my head. Don't hold me to that, Damien. But the numbers of police there worked out roughly to one policeman for every 14 people. The evidence was, getting back to that, that if the police were out driving in a police vehicle and weren't attending to a specific job, they would pull over every single vehicle coming in the only road from the Nunanjara lands into Laverton. That means they were pulling over every single car being driven by an Aboriginal person, regardless of the way the car was being driven, and given them a breath test and done a licence check. And this case highlights one of the real issues that's of concern to people like myself and the Aboriginal Legal Service, and that is the over-policing of the Aboriginal community in Western Australia. The Aboriginal community in Western Australia is chronically over-policed with respect to trivial offending. I'm not saying drink driving is trivial, but offending at the bottom end of that spectrum I referred to at the start, as I say, they're chronically over-policed, and that in turn leads to increased rates of people within the custodial system who are Aboriginal.
But Mr. Ward was drink driving, so there are issues around the safety of the other Indigenous members of the community if he's drink driving.
I accept that, but what it shows is that Aboriginal people are targeted. The police are on the lookout for them incessantly. And I can give you another recent example, Damien, which perhaps illustrates my point a little bit better on this over-policing issue. And it's absolutely catastrophic what happened to this poor boy. I acted recently for a boy who was 16 who suffers from a severe intellectual disability. He was found by police with a $2 stuffed toy down his pants at night. The toy had been stolen by friends he was with out of a car. He was arrested by the police. He'd hardly been in any trouble before. Arrested by the police, taken back to the police station, and released on police bail with a curfew condition. In other words, that he had to be home at certain hours of the night. The police then turned up at the family home the following evening in circumstances where Mum hadn't had the bail conditions properly explained to her. She's the mother, off the top of my head, of about 8 children. They turn up and the boy's not home. He's around the corner at a relative's place with Mum's knowledge. He should have been home according to the condition of the curfew. So the morning after, around about 6 police officers turn up and arrest him. They take him into custody and he appears before a magistrate who was most concerned at what occurred and deleted all of the conditions of bail, including the curfew condition, and adjourned the boy's case to the following week. The police computer wasn't properly linked up with the court computer such that the deletion of the curfew condition made its way to the police computer. The boy was found the following evening by police and arrested. It happened to be a Friday night. He remained in custody in a juvenile detention centre for breaching his curfew condition until he appeared in court on a Monday. So this poor boy spends 3 days in custody for breaching a non-existent curfew condition where he's been arrested and charged by police for receiving a stolen $2 soft toy. Now, if that's not over-policing, I don't know what is. And if that's not profoundly wrong, I don't know what is.
Peter Collins, Director of Legal Services with the WA Aboriginal Legal Aid Service. The dismal overrepresentation of Indigenous people in WA prisons, it's a deeply depressing story. But there are people working in the system who are making positive contributions. Annette Farinaccio is the Employment Coordinator at Roebourne Regional Prison, which is located near the town of Karratha in the northwest of WA. She's involved in some very innovative post-release employment programs. And recently she's also been involved in an employment program involving, at this stage, 2 prisoners who are currently serving their sentences.
We currently have Rio Tinto on board. So Rio Tinto are taking them out to their Cape Lambert operations where they're doing fixed plant and trades assistance work.
Well, what does that mean?
Fixed plant operation is working on their conveyor belts, doing the maintenance, maintaining the conveyor belts that carry the iron ore to the ships, and also working with the tradies on mechanical and things issues with the conveyor belt. So, yeah, they're doing both.
And what sorts of prisoners are being let out from jail to go do this sort of work?
We're talking about minimum security prisoners. So you're looking at people with offences, you know, driving offences, fines, very minimal crimes.
Do these prisoners receive a wage?
Yes, they do. They receive a wage no different than you and me. Everything is to be exactly the same. We arrange for a bank account to be open for them so their wages can be paid into that. We arrange for any debts to come out of that so that maybe if they've got taxation debt or child support, all of those sort of things, we arrange for all of that to be able to be taken out, or fines that could possibly be paid off. So yeah, they have the exact same as you and I would in the workplace.
Tell me about the prisoners at Roebourne Prison. Who are they? Presumably the great bulk are Indigenous.
Yes, 97%, 98%. There's a multitude of different offences that people do come into incarceration for. A large majority of those would be driving offences. I would estimate there to be at least 60% would be made up of driving offences. You're looking at, you know, DUI, driving without a licence, driving unregistered vehicles, all of those sort of things.
What sort of work skills or experience do many of these people have, the prisoners who come through the doors?
Large majority of them, especially if they've come from remote communities, have very little education or very limited work skills. We've been very, very lucky in the prison. We've got a fantastic education manager there who has worked extensively to implement a lot of training and programs on things like numeracy, literacy, you know, all those bits and pieces. And we also look at getting driver's license into place.
Well, that sounds like a crucial part of your work indeed. To arrive at this interview, you just come flying in from Karratha local court. I believe you've been trying to secure what you call an extraordinary license for a prisoner. Is that right?
That's correct, yes. He is to commence work with Rio Tinto. So part of him to commence there is that we must have a licence into place. So we've just come from the courts now to attempt to get this licence into place. So most of mining companies do require you to have a licence in place for OH&S reasons. And it is probably one of the hardest factors for up here to get. So you just don't have driving schools up here, you know, especially in very remote communities.
Presumably often you'll have, you know, a few licensed drivers on a community, so you can't really kind of fill out the logbook, which is a requirement, and sometimes there will be no cars or no registered cars, and lots of people without licences who may or may not be driving around.
Yeah, well, again, I can't comment for all communities, and I can only comment for what's incarcerated at this moment, and it is that exact issues that seem to be bringing people to prison.
Now, Annette Farinaccio, your role includes finding work for prisoners who are currently kind of in prison, but also for offenders once they leave the prison. Tell me about some of the people, some of the ex-prisoners that you've managed to place in employment.
We have one in particular that had long-term institutionalised and hadn't been outside much in the last 20 years. But his dream was to always drive haul packs.
Massive trucks which are used in mining operations.
That's correct. It had been something he thought he could never, ever achieve. But we worked and got him through the Rio Tinto Work Ready course with our education manager there and the superintendent. When he came up for release, we got him a job. And at first, it's very hard. Like, I also do 6 months post-placement support. So once they're out and released, I follow them for at least 6 months to make sure everything goes right. And at first, he did struggle. He has gone on now to succeed very well in driving haul packs. In fact, they actually stated to me they thought he was a natural and that he had done it before where he'd never had. And he's actually moved on to even training or new ones that come through. So that's over an 18-month period that he's proved himself. We've also had a female come out of the prison who wanted the opportunity to change her life. And she, again, long-term institutionalised. And first she tried the haul pack driving, she didn't like it. So we quickly moved on to what she would do, and she works the stores and she actually runs one of their stores now.
Is she racing around in a forklift?
Yes. She does more than that. She does a lot of the paperwork now, so she sort of runs the office side of it now. She's moved on. And again, it's changed her entire life. And with these people, you're seeing things like purchasing their own homes or getting a car or helping their family that might have been in and out of prison as well. I mean, some of them have gone on to get their children into apprenticeships or their partners. They've bought cars. One gentleman rang me and said he's off on a trip to America, which had always been his dream. So it does change lives.
Annette Farinaccio, the employment coordinator at Roebourne Regional Prison in WA.